I don't know how many of you are aware of what is going on in the outside world. It is delightful to hear of the experiences of people who bind themselves together here in this place, the kind of warmth, the kind of unity that sets us apart in such a way that we suddenly forget that the world outside of us is there, and that what is happening out there is not at all comfortable. And one of the things that is on the way that you need to know about is one of the moves of Red China. The move of Red China, which is saying to the Western world that unless you capitulate, the Third World War is on the way, and we are going to wipe America off the face of the earth. Unless you capitulate and surrender to the Red Chinese, to the Communists, you are all going to be annihilated. And this demand of the Reds is not something that is an idle threat. For they claim that even though we can fire whatever we will at them in retaliation, it will mean that they will survive and we will not. That they can throw up some kind of neutron wall to defend themselves. Now, such a claim and such a shout is not a foolish thing. If a prophet dares to say that God may well be in a role of punishing this country, the people of God right here, and that he might even say, let the world, let the Third World War come, and that your task may very well be just that, to surrender to the enemy. Not because you think communism is right or wrong, but because somehow, if the people of God are to survive, they've got to reach the rest of the world with the message of Jesus Christ, with the message that they are God's people. And if they don't exist, if they've been wiped off, where do you stand? Would you be willing to surrender if there was no way out against the communists? Now that sounds like good, solid treason. And that's exactly what it was, as far as the people of Israel were concerned, when Jeremiah preached. Good, solid treason. If you look for a moment at chapter 37 and 38, the prophet is faced with the Babylonians, the Nebuchadnezzar's army all around Jerusalem. The place is under attack. The enemy is there. And they say to Jeremiah, pray for us, that God will save us, in verse 3. And Jeremiah says, no. God has told me it is no longer possible to pray for this people. The judgment and the punishment must come. And even if, he says, if you look down at verse 10, even if you Israelites should defeat the army of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians that is, who are fighting against you, and there remain only wounded men, every man in his tent would rise up and burn the city with fire. When God decides that it's time, then there is no way of stopping it. And the only solution for Israel is that they should surrender. Look at 38 verse 2. 38 verse 2. Thus says the Lord, whoever stays in this city shall die by the sword, and by famine, and by pestilence. But the person who goes out and surrenders to the Babylonians shall live. And he shall have his life as a prize of war. Jeremiah was put in prison for treason for that. As a traitor to the people of God, as a traitor to God, and a traitor to Israel. Because he dared to say that God was bringing judgment upon his people. There's a little story after that, a touching story, right in the middle of all this ugliness, all in the middle of all this treason and war, there Jeremiah was thrown into a pit, into the mud. And there's the Good Samaritan story of the Old Testament right there. A Negro court official by the name of Evan Melick finds Jeremiah in the pit. And the rescuer, at the risk of his own neck, comes and pulls Jeremiah out with soft, rotten rags, not to hurt him. And the old man survives once again in the midst of all of this agony. A little touching soul in the midst of this whole evil world that was there. And so the day came when the city would fall and everyone would be destroyed. There was no solution. I'd like to stop for a moment and say, how was it that Jeremiah got to that point where he said the only answer was to surrender to the enemy, because the enemy is not just Babylon, but God. And unless you recognize God some way, if you can't recognize him as the one who brought you good, at least you can recognize him as the man who brings, as the God who brings judgment. It all began back in chapter 2, where Jeremiah sees Israel on trial. If you look at Jeremiah 2, starting from verse 4, if you're following along, it's the story of Israel on trial. And time and again, God puts Israel on trial. But he always begins by saying, let me take the blame first. I'm willing to take the blame if you can show where I fail. A God who's willing to take the blame is quite a God. And they didn't ask all the good things I did. And he lists from 2 verse 6 all the things that God had done for Israel. He had brought them out of Egypt. He brought them across the wilderness. He brought them to the land of Israel. He'd given them everything. And now they, in turn, had left him and worshipped other gods. Verse 9. Therefore I will take you to court, he said. I will bring you to court, and you can cross over from the west to the east, and you won't find any kind of international precedent for this kind of thing that Israel has done. Other nations will add their gods. They will include new gods, but no gods, no country has ever decided to swap gods the way Israel has. That you take the true God and swap that God for what's nothing, for what's worthless. And Israel has taken what is the essence, the true, the glory, the real thing, and substituted that for nothing, for Baal. And so he puts Israel on trial all through chapter 2. And the questions are put to Israel again and again and again. And Jeremiah says, verse 22, for example, though you wash yourself with lye and use as much soap as you can, you will never get the guilt out. Israel had become so ingrained with evil that they couldn't change any longer. There was no option. They had become just so much sin. They had become evil. They had become not just hypocrites, but hypocrisy had become second nature to them. That they would always worship the false thing. And so there was no solution any longer but to eradicate it and start all over again. In one place, Jeremiah says, just as the leopard can't change his spots, and the black man cannot change his skin, so you cannot change your way of doing evil. It's become what you are. You have become evil. And so there was no way out. And he goes through the trial of Israel and puts all the questions to her and all the accusations of what Israel had done. For example, verse 27, the biting piece of satire. He says, you say to the tree, you are my father. And to a stone, you say, you gave me birth. He deliberately switched them around because the tree was really the mother and the stone was really the father symbol in Baal worship. And finally, the people in verse 35 cry, we're innocent. We didn't do a thing. God says, therefore, I must bring the judgment upon you. The whole picture of God's people on trial is a real one. And we cannot ignore the fact that the church, too, is still today on trial. And all of us are on trial before God. We stand on trial before God every moment of our life. It's a very wonderful section at the beginning of Arthur Miller's book, After the Fall, where he tells a story about the lawyer. And the lawyer says, I've lived all of my life as though I were a case at court. And I'm trying to prove all the time, when I'm a boy, how athletic I am. When I'm a young man, how virile and how manly I am. When I'm older, how popular I am, how I've achieved it in business. I'm always trying to prove something, And finally, at the end, I want a verdict of some kind, at least a verdict, yes or no. And I look up, and the bench is empty. And that's the sad feeling about so many people in this world, that they are trying to prove something, that they sense the trial of life, but they don't know where to find the verdict. And perhaps indeed we ought to say the bench is empty, because God has not deigned to stay just on the bench, but to come down and become one of us. That we don't need to look just to the bench, but that we need to look at the man at our side, the advocate who takes us case in court before God. A couple more things to get a feel of just how powerful this doom picture is in Jeremiah, and how it leads to a point where he solves it all by starting all over again. In chapter 4, the doom builds up in a way that finally he sees all of the world as though it were just this cosmic universal conflict, just this cosmic cobalt bomb destroying the world. And the whole Third World War almost seems right before us if we turn to chapter 4. The enemy starts to come in verse 13. It comes with chariots and whirlwinds. It reaches all the way down to Dan. Then it comes a little further south and reaches Mount Ephraim. A little further south and finally gets to Jerusalem. And it gets into the city of Jerusalem, breaks through the people, gets to the heart of the city, and finally hits Jeremiah's own tent. And Jeremiah is there screaming. And he says, "Oh, the pain in my heart." Jeremiah feels all of that doom and that evil before it ever happens. And he looks up from his little tent. He looks up in his pain, and what does he see? Verse 23. "I looked, and the world was waste and void. I looked at the heavens, and there was no light. I looked at the mountains, and they were quaking. I looked at the hills, and they wobbled to and fro. I looked, and lo, there was no man. I looked, and lo, the fruitful land was a desert, and all the cities were laid waste before the anger of his God." Jeremiah sees, as it were, the end of the world. Everything is affected by the doom that is coming. And so in chapter 5, he searches to try and find one man in that city who is righteous enough. And he looks through the city. Look at chapter 5, 1 to 5. "Run through the city and see if you can find one man who does justice and speaks truth and does not swear falsely." And he goes to the rich and he goes to the poor. And there isn't one man. If there had been one man in Sodom, it would have been spared. Not just 10, one. But there's not even one in Jerusalem. And so the city must go. If God ever is to keep his threats, God is to be proved and shown to be God. But there's one word there that needs to make us stop for a moment. One of Jeremiah's words that occurs all through his book is the word falsely, the word sham, the word hypocrite. That Israel had become what their masks were. The masks of evil, the masks of following their own way, the masks of worshiping what was not the real thing, but the idol. Worshiping the things of the temple, worshiping the objects of the temple. Not bowing down to them, but seeing these as the symbol of security, the false symbol. And so their masks had become second nature, their nature. And every one of us has to stop every once in a while and ask, what are the masks that we are wearing? What is the false front that we have on that makes us fake before God and sham before God? And we all wear masks, and I think we can all take time out once in a while to ask just exactly what we look like before other people, exactly what we look like before God. And when we see ourselves as we really are, not just in the mirror, but in the face behind the mirror, and the mask. We begin to realize that we need someone to help us take off that mask. We need someone to help us step behind the mask and find us there and see us as we are. And all of this doom and all of this picture of the terror that is coming down, it's important to see that for Jeremiah, the whole picture of doom is a beginning. The evil had to be exposed. If you didn't expose the evil for what it was, there would be no way of getting around it. It had to be exposed for what it was. And the mask had to be taken off of God. The mask had to be taken off of Israel. The mask had to be taken off of everything that was there to show what was really at the root of it all. What was really happening. And then the new beginning would come. And we'll talk about that new beginning tomorrow. But let's just stop for a moment and see how similar what is happening here is what happened at Calvary, where the mask was taken off of man and the mask was taken off of God. And we saw what the evil forces of man do. And we see what the love of God does in return. Let us look at that exposed God and that exposed man and behold the man from whom there is life and more than just a sham. That we do not substitute false gods for that real thing. Tomorrow, I'd like you to look at 23:1-8, chapters 30-32. And those of you who are here on the week to follow, it's kind of unfortunate in a short Bible study that you don't have a chance to ask questions and answer back and all the rest of it. We'll have a chance to discuss some of the things that we've talked about rather quickly and bitingly here in the mornings. So chapters 23:1-8 and then 30-32 we'll pick up tomorrow morning. Okay.